there are pilots. There are really good pilots. And then once in a while, a pilot comes along who is so extraordinary, both as a pilot and as a person in the air and on the ground, that it's impossible to adequately describe that person. There is a man who fits that description.
Oh, I see you spotted the name in the plane, Bob Hoover. He used to be a test pilot, one of the best. Today, he's manager of customer relations for North America's Los Angeles division, and he's the man who demonstrates this plane. Well, here he comes now. You know, he flies this plane in a business suit and without a parachute. Hi, Bob. We've just been admiring this beauty of yours.
Beauty she is, and she flies like a dream. Tell you what, folks, climb in with me now, and let's see what we can do.
In the air, in World War II, he fought to save our country from those who would try to take away our freedoms. On the ground, he has committed himself to our country's values and has always reflected those values in his own daily life so that we never forget who we are as Americans and how so many have given their lives to keep America safe and free. He soloed at 16, but then had to teach himself aerobatics to overcome air sickness. A few years later, in Air Corps primary pilot training, he was so good at aerobatics that his commander had him teach all of his instructors aerobatics. He flew combat in Europe, was taken prisoner in Germany. He escaped and commandeered a German Focke-Wulf 190 and flew it to Holland. After the war, as a test pilot, he flew hundreds of different models of airplanes. One flight, October 14, 1947, he flew chase on the Bell XS-1. That was man's first successful supersonic flight when the pilot lived to tell about it. And who can ever forget the first time they saw Bob fly his Mustang and Shrike Commander in air shows around the world? Jimmy Doolittle introduced him as the greatest stick and rudder pilot who ever lived. Please welcome Bob Hoover.
Morning, Bob. On April 2nd this year at Uwe-Hodze Smithsonian Air and Space, the second bronze life-size statue of an aviator was unveiled at Uwe-Hodze, and it was of Bob Hoover. The first and the only other life-size statue at Smithsonian is Billy Mitchell. So Bob is in rare company, and so is Billy Mitchell. Bob, good morning.
My dear friend, what a treat to be with you.
And what a treat to be with you again as well. Good morning. Bob, what does that mean to you? When we were there that night at Uwe-Hodze in April, and to have that statue of you, and you've already got your two airplanes there, the Aero Commander and the Mustang, are in the museum. What do those honors mean to you, coming from Smithsonian and the aviation community?
Well, the truth of the matter is, there are far more people that deserve this than I ever was capable of receiving it. But I am tickled to death because so many people believed in what I did and why I did it, and they donated an enormous amount of money, and I guess it got into the real big dollars, and all of the money over and above the cost of the statue went to the museum. And I've done a lot of those kind of things that I'm really proud of. And if you don't mind my bragging a little bit, I made $1,013,000 out of one movie at the premiere only. And the people who invested in the movie said, "Bob, we made that donation, and it's your money. what do you want to do with it? I said, I want to put it into aviation. And I donated the money to the Embry-Riddle Air College and for scholarships. And I now had some classes graduating. And I'm very proud of it.
Bob, thinking I'm here we are to honor every year for a week honoring veterans. We have over 2 million veterans now in the United States, American veterans. When you think about our veterans today, what goes through your mind?
Well, I can respond to that easily. I have some very dear friends. I don't know how many of you know Mike Herman, but he is a very dear close friend of mine, and he uses his private business jet every weekend that he can. He goes to a Veterans Administration hospital and finds some wounded soldier from one of our war days, and he says, when was the last time you saw your family? And the young man will say, it's been a very long time. I don't have the money, or I'm too crippled to go visit them, or we can't get to, I can't get to see my family. He flies them from wherever they live, the veteran takes him to his home, goes back and picks him up 3 days later, after, I'll say on Sunday, and brings him back to the hospital. He has organized other people who have a private business jet and do just exactly what Mike has done, and I think he ought to get a big recognition.
Mike Herman.
Let's give it to him.
And Mike, by the way, was the gentleman who came
Mike
out.
Mike Herman.
Mike came out with us just a few minutes ago. Bob, as many times as we've spoken and we've, you know, heard stories, and most of the people here know a lot of the stories about your career, but there are certain little details that sometimes get missed. And if you would, let me take you to a couple of those stories and try to recall some of the details. You heard in the video ahead about the fact, you know, Bob was shot down. He was 16 months a prisoner of war in Stalag I in northern Germany. He escaped. There was a recently deserted German airfield. He was able to get in the Focke-Wulf 190 and flew it with German markings, mind you, of course, across Germany to land in Holland. You landed in Holland in a field. Bob, how is it that you didn't get shot when you landed in Holland flying a German airplane?
Well, I really had a problem. Germany, when they retreated all across North Africa, when we would take over an airfield, we couldn't land on it, beautiful runway, because the Germans, when they deserted after we were pushing them back, they would put landmines in the runway. And when our forces came in, and we didn't have to do that but about once or twice, and we decided we don't land on an airfield that we have recovered from the Germans. And on my escape, I've got to just back up and say, it was the dumbest thing anybody ever did. The war was 2 weeks from being over. The Germans were deserting, and I was so in the mind of escaping, and I had done nothing but try to escape from the day they got me, and I could talk to you for hours about the things I did and experienced. And to sum it all up, I was beaten up on many occasions for my attempts at escape when they recaptured me, and I never gave up going for it. And I got my inspiration from a colonel who was shot down before me. And he had heard from He was a wonderful fighter pilot.
Russ Spicer,
one of the finest people you've ever met. And Russ was captured, and he was rescued. He was shot down in a P-47, as a matter of fact. And he landed in the water, got in his life raft. It was winter time on the Baltic Sea, and by the time they recovered him, he had gotten up on the beach, and he was found unconscious by the Germans. And they brought him into our prison camp, and he stood up and said, "Gentlemen, General Patton, I've just learned, has gone out in front of all of his supply supports." And he had almost 1,000 men. And the Germans realized that Patton had outrun his supply forces for ammunition, everything. He was so far ahead of the troops coming in. And the Germans got smart, and they pulled a pincer and closed him in. So 1,000 men were right there captured. And the Germans came in and shot every one of them. Two of the people survived, and they were received. They recovered enough to where they brought them into the same hospital that I ended up in in a prison camp, and I had a chance to visit with them.